Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Jack Farley, joined by Samuel Burke and Weston Nakamura. It's July 1st. Today, we had some jobless claims that posted a larger than expected decline. Samuel?
Yeah, Jack, we're also following really what's happening with oil, $75 a barrel, its highest since 2018. I'm very curious to see what Weston sees as the developing world demand goes up, but we wait for the developing world to have their demand go up as well.
Yeah, really a who's who if you look at the stocks that are going up the most in the energy sector, like Marathon Oil, really energy sector up about 1.5% today. The dollar index also on the move up 0.3%. Today is also the first trading day of the second half of 2021. So in this episode, Samuel, I want to look back on the first half of 2021, see if we can glean any lessons, as well as look forward to what we can maybe expect.
Yeah, it's also the first day of trading for Krispy Kreme for the second time around, their second IPO. It started off with a little bit of a glaze, but now it's turned sweet. But Jack, I can't wait to see those charts that show that the IPOs this year are literally off the charts.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect way to invite our guest, Weston. What did you make of the market action today?
Well, for today, to be honest, I actually don't know where everything closed, but you know, it would just seem like it was very much centered on the OPEC and crude situation. Crude obviously got a very nice lift, but otherwise, yeah, like you said, it's the start of the second half of the year. First half was pretty historic, to say the least. So we'll see where we're from there.
Yeah, just to give people at home the context, OPEC met today and they announced that they would raise their exports by about 400,000 barrels. And that actually is less than the market was expecting. So oil rallied on the news, Brent surging to above $75 yet again. And as I mentioned in the open, the oil stocks surged today. That was the sector that led the most in the S&P 500.
And Weston, what I'm really curious here is clearly what's happened is, as I was mentioning, the developed world, there's so much demand there. But if you look at the developing world, I mean, everything's reversed. It used to be the other way around for the few years leading up to COVID. So what do you see then as the developing world, hopefully we'll get more vaccines, come back online? Do you think then demand will surge even more?
So if you're talking about just generally like, you know, like EMs versus DM indices, you know, the EM, I hate to just simplify it so much, but it is very much so a dollar related trade, you know, especially given a lot of them are commodities tied as well. But as far as the developed markets, the major markets are concerned, I was actually talking about this on the exchange earlier with Jeremiah, who's one of our very prolific, smart, gifted contributors. But, you know, we were talking about how the Australian dollar correlated with the S&P as well as the Nikkei indices, AUD, JPY to be specific, because of the carry trade. And then you basically have Japan as the clear laggard of the year. It's actually EWJ, the ETF, is flat on the year. Every other country ETF is up nearly double digits, except for Japan and China. Japan is lagging in indices. The yen is the, I think, second worst performing macro asset year to date, behind the Turkish lira. The next to follow is, like, you know, gold down like 6% and all that, but the yen is just getting absolutely destroyed. Japan is basically has a lot of, or what I believe is that Europe has a lot of Japan's flows, you know, kind of stolen away from it. Japan has a lot of this vaccines, you know, issues, and we have Olympics coming up at the end of the month. That's going to be a disaster. But I actually think that after that dust has settled, Japan will then outperform because Japan will have a delayed, you know, reopening trade happening when everything, when the reopen is clearly done with, in the US and Europe.
Let's get into specifics. Weston, how are you thinking about the reopening trade, the reflation trade? They overlap. Specifically, I'm thinking about energy and financials.
Yeah, so last time I was on with you guys, I was talking about how energy, although it's clearly the outperformer year to date, I think that there's just a lot of people who are very, very underweight energy. And just because you see price appreciation doesn't mean it's a crowded trade per se. In fact, the more that it outperforms, the less likely, especially in this particular case with energy, the less likely it is that there are, like every hedge fund and every asset manager already long and overweight. They might actually just have stepped back at this point, and you might just have a very small proportionally small handful of market participants in these names. And so I think that you still have a lot of firepower left. I think there's a lot of people who just don't want to buy the energy sector for one reason or another, be it ESG or their view on value versus growth or whatever it is. So I think that there's probably some surprise upside left there. As far as the financials are concerned, I mean, that's a yield curve steepening or flattening trade, more or less. There's a lot of the, I guess the upside is priced in. I am very curious to see, I'll probably get to this later, but this Robinhood IPO and how that affects brokerage companies. And, companies like Morgan Stanley have acquired E-Trade and they now have a brokerage arm themselves. So they're kind of very much thrown into that mix too. So I think that you're going to get a lot of impact from how the, HOOD trades.
We've got a question coming in, Weston. We have Gabrielle saying, how high can oil go over the next month, 3 months, $80? Also, what's the deal with low volume and new highs? And I know we have Bank of America putting $100 on the map.
Yeah, $100. Look, there's a lot of open interest in options right around the 100 strike. So you'll probably, it'll be tough to break it through 80. But then once through 80, you'll probably get to 100. This is if, right? I don't believe that this is, it's not my view. But if it does break through 80, it'll probably get to 100 faster than people think. At 100, though, you're going to have that, that dynamic where market makers who are sold these calls on 100 strike oil are essentially hedging, and they'll be kind of dampening the price. If it breaks through 100, it's going a lot higher, a lot faster. But we're still kind of a ways away from that. But it can get there quicker than people think. At the same time, too, look, like I said last time, too, one negative headline from OPEC, and you can get a pretty nasty unwind of this long crude trade.
Yeah, the headline was not nasty today. I believe earlier in the week, oil traded down, the energy stocks traded down, perhaps in anticipation of a negative headline. But that negative headline did not appear. Again, the projections of supply raises was well within the range, did not alarm markets at all. And also, there is some disputes between the members of OPEC, between Russia and Saudi Arabia on one side, really the dominant players there, trying to put the United Arab Emirates, in its place, kind of. The UAE, they want to pump more. It's unclear to what degree Russia and Saudi Arabia will be able to coax the UAE to play ball. But we're waiting on additional news tomorrow from OPEC. Weston, one question I want to ask you about the energy trade. You think if oil goes past 80, it could go above 100. And of course, anything could happen. My question is, what's it going to take to really drag the energy stocks to their next leg higher? I look at XLE, the S&P energy sector ETF, and it's really been sort of stuck in the mud around 50, even though over the past month, oil has continued to make new highs. Is it just the fact that the futures curve is just, so deep in backwardation that markets are really pricing in the future? Or, what's it going to take for the next leg going to be in the energy stocks?
Well, with regards to XLE, I'm just going off the top of my head, so I might be completely wrong here, but I'm pretty sure that XLE is just very heavily weighted in ExxonMobil and I think it's not ConocoPhillips.
Chevron.
Chevron. Right. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
I think that those two are the a huge percentage of what XLE is. So XLE is basically those two stocks, and then miscellaneous. So yeah, with regards to those two, if XOM and Chevron don't do so well or underperforming, then XLE won't do, will trade accordingly. I think that a lot of times too, because those are these sort of, I guess, the blue chips within energy, in terms of, long short funds that are doing like kind of market neutral pair trading, they'll go long a more speculative, higher beta oil name and then short an XOM. And so if that's the case and everyone's using XOM or Chevron to use as the funding short, XLE itself will not perform. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, it's just going to be crude itself. I mean, crude at 100 is not going to just leave oil stocks flat, right? At some point, I do think that the U.S. government is probably going to have to, I don't know, at least pretend to step in or notice, that higher oil prices are not necessarily good for the average American in terms of the knock-on effects of prices that they pay for, inflation, gas prices, all that kind of thing too. So,
hi everybody, I'm Katie Segal,
and I'm Kurt Sutter,
and welcome to our new podcast called PIE: People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know ya at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, that's a nuanced point. I actually believe that the stocks that have been up the most in the entire S&P 500 have been those high beta, cyclical, maybe lower quality stocks like Marathon Oil. I think Marathon Oil, up until recently, was the number one best performing stock in the entire S&P 500. And of course, that outpaced the higher quality names, Chevron, Exxon, which, as you correctly say, comprise a disproportionate amount of the S&P 500. Let's move on to another big story, which is that today Robinhood announced that it will file publicly for its IPO. Samuel, can you break down this story for us? Why does it matter and why is it such a big deal?
Well, listen, this is a company that now has 18 million users. We weren't aware of how many accounts they had before, and it's really changed the entire market. I mean, when you look at how much retail investing doubled, especially over the pandemic, when people were sitting at home able to do trades and using their stimulus checks to do these trades, I mean, this has fundamentally changed the market. We saw other numbers too, that they were profitable last year, only by about $7 million. Weston will point out, though, they have skyrocketing losses this year. I really want to step back with you, Weston, and think about how, given the fact that Robinhood has changed the market so fundamentally, what could they do with this money to make their next move? One thing that's always stood out to me about Robinhood is the fact that they're only in the United States. They had these big plans to go overseas, to come to the UK. They eventually had to scrap those plans. So I wonder if that type of money that they'll be able to raise from this IPO will finally get them overseas.
I think that they'll have to probably put their overseas ambitions aside for now. I don't know. Obviously, I don't know what they're planning on doing with the money they raise. I think that they're actually, I mean, look, this is not a like a Schwab type of company that's been around for a very long time. They have tremendous amount of issues. They have IT issues. They have blackouts when volume is very high at the open, which is usually a time when something is going on and traders need to get into their accounts and be able to transact. And that's happened countless times. And by the way, it's not just Robinhood who that happens with either. But remember back in January with this whole GME thing, when they had to, you know, cut off buying of shares of GME, they did that because they were not able to meet their margin requirements with the clearinghouse. And so they had to go out and raise $3 billion in the span of like 2 or 3 days, which is very impressive, especially considering the fact that at the time, Robinhood was going through a horrific PR nightmare and still able to raise, you know, funds during that time. But they did that just so that they can meet their basic operating requirements, right? So I think that, you know, what they're just trying to basically, this is not for expansion necessarily. This is just to sort of maintain, you know, trend, if you will. Keep in mind, too, that the more assets, you know, the more money that Robinhood, I don't want to say customers, because Robinhood customers are the people that pay them revenue. So Robinhood has like 5 customers, like Citadel, Jump Street, all those like, you know, off exchange market makers. Robinhood users, the millions of them, those people, the more that their account values grow and they are growing, the more of a burden it is for Robinhood in terms of, you know, collateral that they have to post and all that kind of thing, too. So this is just trying to keep up with the gains that their users are amassing.
Well, I think it's very interesting you have that viewpoint, because of course, so often when you're investing in tech companies, it's because of their incredible scale. And before we went on for RVDB right now, you said, how are they going to expand overseas when they can barely even keep their house in check at home? To your point, Weston, Robinhood just had to just announced that they had to pay a $70 million fine for exactly some of the things that you were talking about: widespread technical problems on the platform during periods of high volatility, where at times some traders were losing tens of thousands of dollars as a result of that. But FINRA also saying that they gave customers misleading information about how much cash they had on hand and didn't even report complaints that they're required to pass on to FINRA. So certainly you would be right to assume that they're going to use some of that money to try and clean up house. And they've already started hiring people that I've known much more in the mainstream to run tech companies. I know one of the major leaders from Facebook they brought over to run PR. So I think you're spot on when you say that. And it's interesting because their opportunity to expand overseas may have been lost at this point, in the sense that first marketplace doing it looks like it's really been filled with people like eToro, some of those competitors, so they may have lost their chance there. One thing to point out, Jack, the Robinhood is allocating 35% of its IPO shares to individual investors. That number is usually only about 10% for retail, and that's usually not used by retail investors directly. It's gobbled up by other people. Weston, I know you have some thoughts on Robinhood allocating that many shares to its own users.
First of all, so they have a dual class share structure. I mean, I just kind of flipped through just really quick what the filing was. Apparently, they have, you know, Class A shares, Class B shares. Class B shares are just going to be owned by the two founders, I suppose, and they have like 10x the voting rights. So, you know, Robinhood, you know, very generous of them. Thank you for allocating 35% to retail. I think that what I was thinking about was that it's kind of amusing to think about this notion that Robinhood itself might become a meme stock, HOOD. If that becomes a meme stock, In a sense, it's kind of funny that Robinhood. Okay, so they did $7 million in net income. Apparently, it's like they're looking at a $40 billion valuation. That's a PE of 5,700x, which means that of course Robinhood is not going to trade on fundamentals of all stocks, right? But let's say that there's a short squeeze on Robinhood, or some sort of a GME situation on Robinhood. First of all, if these traders are sending their trades through Robinhood to buy Robinhood, then for once, that actually does make fundamental sense for the stock to rise, because every time you're buying Robinhood through Robinhood, Robinhood is making money, and therefore its stock price should be going up by virtue of its stock price going up. But let's say that it actually starts to become like this hockey stick situation like G&E, right, where you get like a gamma squeeze, where there's way out of the money, you know, 0.01 delta strike calls that are suddenly in the money, and ever higher strikes are listed. And as soon as they are, the traders are jumping into them, you know, furthest out of the money call. Market makers who sold the calls have to buy shares of HOD, Delta Hedge, so on and so forth. Let's say stocks going up 4x a week, right? That actually really can't happen because of what we were talking about before. There's kind of a self-correcting mechanism, because Robinhood itself has limitations as to how much collateral it can post, and they might cut off buying on their own shares to their own users. And so it might not ever get to that kind of level, because it's only going to be their customers that are executing those sort of orders. So they might be their own dampener on the stock going, you know, too crazy, too much.
You know, Weston, go ahead, Samuel.
Just one question quite coming in from our users while we're still talking about Robinhood. How would a liquidation event in markets impact Robinhood's ability to continue to grow, Weston? Do you think a major move would shake out considerable portions of their user base?
No, because you have to understand what these people are, this base of investors. They are not playing, this is just a casino to them. Okay, I'm not talking about everybody, but I'm talking about most people who are buying out of the money calls and all that kind of thing. They are fine with losing 100% of their premium on a super out of the money option. Most of that was, a lot of it was not even there, you know, like out of pocket anyway. If they use their stimulus checks and they grew it to, you know, 10, 50, 100x, they took that principal back. Not that that was theirs, you know, that was from the US government anyway. And so they're all playing just with house money anyway. So they don't really care about losses and liquidation events and all that. Like we're dealing with a cohort of investors who are not afraid of losses, who are almost who brag about their losses. That is not something that we've seen before. And we have to keep that in mind, because every time we say, who's going to buy a stock at that price? Well, somebody who doesn't care about losses would. And those people exist now. So the nature of the market behavior itself has changed because of the arrival of this group of people who are 15% of new traders that signed up in the last 12 months account for more than 50% of volume. So I don't think that a liquidation event is going to be any big deal to anyone except for people who care about liquidation events, and that's not these people.
Well, Weston, it's interesting you say that. I feel like the meme stock crowd, they definitely have a high tolerance for volatility, and in many cases, they seek it out. In many cases, they seek to create the volatility and sort of become the chaos. I don't think that they are unopinionated about which direction they want their accounts to go. They definitely want to make a lot of money. So yeah, I think that you know, when they have these highly leveraged positions, they could go to zero, and they could, you know, they could have to be forced to be offside and no longer a participant in the market. I want to go back to something you said earlier, Weston, which is that the planned valuation is $40 billion. I believe in 2020, Robinhood closed the funding round at about $12 billion in total equity valuation, and then when it accepted additional money in very late January, early February, when it was having funding problems, both by drawing upon emergency credit lines as well as accepting additional equity investment, I would be very surprised if that additional equity investment weren't at a discount to that $12 billion, because they had to make some calls overnight. And you know how these things happen. So a move from $12 billion to perhaps less than $12 billion valuation, now a move to $40 billion, quite a move.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's see where the stock actually opens. All that $40 billion is just some stupid first glance whisper number, you know. But yeah, I mean, but look, this is a stock that's not gonna trade on fundamentals, right? Of course, it's gonna have a 4-digit PE probably. If it ever dips in 3-digit PEs, hey, that's a buying opportunity on Robinhood.
Yeah, that's price to earnings ratio, PE. For people at home who are looking at a way to get exposure to meme stocks, not to buy them, but to profit from the existence and the phenomenon of meme stocks and all this overtrading and crazy gamma squeezes, perhaps they would look at Virtue Financial, which is a publicly traded high-frequency trading firm, which I believe trades at a price to earnings ratio of about 7. So perhaps that's an alternative to investing in this Robinhood.
There's a reason for that, though. So I would say, actually, if you want to do the exchanges, even though a lot of these transactions occur off exchange, the exchanges actually are the winners. You know, the CME, the SIBO, ICE, NASDAQ. Yeah.
I just want to change gears for a bit and get back to the inflation discussions that we've been having, particularly around labor inflation. The U.S. jobless claims posted a larger than expected decline. Prior week numbers fell to 364,000, down 51,000 from a week prior. Jobless claims are at a pandemic low now. I'm just curious, as we look at this, Weston, when you think about the fact that so many people say the next few weeks actually could be very decisive in giving us a clearer picture of the labor market in the United States, because those extended jobless benefits are ending. But then, on the other hand, you hear a lot of people talking about maybe September will give us a clearer picture, because people will find out, are their kids going to be back in school? No more remote learning. Can a parent go back to the office? Can a parent go back to work who is having to stay at home with a kid? And not just talking about the U.S. there, outside the U.S., that still remains a question. So I'm just curious to see, as you see these numbers continue to go down at faster than expected rates, how that influences your bigger view about labor inflation.
Here's what I'll say about labor. So first of all, the labor data is tomorrow is the big one. They're always the big ones, right? So tomorrow, the non-farm payrolls, so last time I checked, I think the estimate was like 700K. The range is somewhere like between 400,000 on the low side and over a million, which means that kind of dispersion means that Wall Street estimates have no idea what the hell they're talking about. This is no different from when, we had labor data from, 2 months ago, when the high end estimates were at 2 million, over 2 million, 2.2 million. And then they came in with like 250,000. So it's like a 10x miss, largest miss on Wall Street history. At the same time, and I mentioned this a few, I think maybe, one or two times the last time I was on the show, was that on the exchange, we just started a program. This guy, Brad Snyder, and I, who was a very sharp young truck driver, who just basically takes laps around the northeastern United States through cornfields, through urban areas. He sees industries. He sees everything. He sees everything on a week to week change basis, and he reports that back to us. And we're getting real time macro data from him that he's seeing. And so, as it relates to something like when Wall Street is the most wrong that it's ever been, and it will be because we're in truly unprecedented, uncertain times. And they just have inputs that just don't make sense, or they're making outputs that don't make sense, or both. Right now we have, with exchanging lanes, we have this resource in which we can see what's going on in a very much a real-time sort of manner. There is no other profession besides, a truck driver that could actually provide that kind of week-over-week data for such a huge and diverse geographic area of the United States. So, for example, for labor, we were talking about these alternative explanations for why people are unable to get hired. As you mentioned, there might be childcare issues and things like that. And September, we'll see what happens when the extended unemployment benefits, run out. But we were also talking about, he was talking about how he was at, I forgot where, I think it might've been somewhere in Pennsylvania. He was at a gas station and he happened to see like this help wanted sign for somebody hiring. But there's the little caveat that said, you will start at like $15 or $16 an hour until September. And then you will drop down like $1 or $2 or $3 per hour, for your salary. So these elevated sort of wages, and this can't be the only business that has ever thought of this sort of concept or scheme. So I have to think that there's probably a lot of companies out there who are giving these elevated wages and offerings that are not meant to be permanent. And as soon as September rolls around, or maybe shortly after, it might drop off.
You can try, I don't know, you can try all you want for wages not to be permanent. Of course, that's what a lot of these companies would like that are having to pay people these increased wages. But once you get to a certain level, I mean, just yesterday, Jared Dillian, I think, was saying right here on the Daily Briefing, once those numbers are there, they're hard to get back down. And I mean, a lot of the reasons that people are waiting for September, they say, I still can't find childcare for my children because there aren't enough people to hire, can't hire a nanny, can't hire the normal daycare folks we had around. Summer camps still closed because they can't find people.
Yeah, people afraid to go to work and vaccinations. Yeah, sure. But yeah, I totally agree. You can't decrease the salary, but you can do layoffs. That's what I'm talking about. Like, that's what's scary. Yeah.
The other thing that I keep on hearing anecdotally, although it seems more than anecdotal at this point, is the half the people I know who can't wait to get back into the office, and the other half of the people who want to stay at home. And for some of the people I know whose offices have closed, because obviously it's much more financially advantageous, they're saying, well, I want to go to those companies where I can get out of my kid's bedroom and back into an office. And then for those people saying, well, no, I want to stay on the outskirts of London, the outskirts of New York, or if they've moved to Florida, I mean, those people really seem to have the advantage in their hand, because I know lots of people who say that they're looking to change companies actively because they don't think they'll be going back to the office, or they think they'll be going back to the office. So they're going to be looking for a new employer. And a lot of that says to me that the advantage is in the hands of the employee or potential employee.
I agree with that specific demographic, with the kind of higher skilled white collar worker who has that leverage. Yeah. But people who have to, who cannot work from home, people in the services industry and things like that, I don't think that there is much more leverage. I think that leverage is going to be tilted disproportionately towards sort of white collar, higher paid, higher skilled sort of, you know, jobs.
Fair point. And Jack, I think it will become much clearer in the next few weeks when those extended jobless benefits end.
Definitely. Well, what I was interested in, Samuel, is that it was a narrow beat in terms of the jobless claims was slightly lower than expected. But the bond market actually rallied on the news slightly, a few basis points, like 2.5 basis points. But typically, the response you see is that on job market strength, you see bonds selling off because they want to flee safe assets and go to a home like energy, financials, or seek risk, seek reflationary, seek assets that are correlated with a growing economy that is itself correlated with lowering jobless claims. But Weston, what did you make of the slight bond rally?
I didn't notice it, so I guess it wasn't.
That's how slight it was.
It was slight. Well, I spoke with an investor today who I'm interviewing shortly, and he said that he thinks that if the next consumer price index has a 5 in front of it, in other words, if the next inflation reading is 5 point something, extremely high, he actually thinks that long-term treasury yields will decline because that will force the Fed to raise short-term rates at a sooner date than they anticipated, and that would forestall inflation. And that was very surprising to me. It's like third level thinking.
Yeah, I hesitate. While I agree with the logic, I hesitate because we have a 5% CPI and Fed funds are at 0. Why are they at 0? They're at 0 because the Fed decided that, yes, although we have a 5% CPI, which is insane, it's transitory. So therefore, we're going to leave. So basically, Fed funds, like rate adjustments and things like that, this doesn't just happen automatically. This is just a decision of like human beings that sit around and make dots on pieces of paper. And so they can kind of come up with any reason to or not to do something regardless of the data. They can have different degrees of data dependency. But as far as the like markets are concerned, or treasuries, if you want to just, all you have to do is pull up a chart, very simply put up a chart of the US 5-year yield or the 10-year US treasury yield, then put up a chart of USD JPY and you'll see your, just put them on top of each other and you'll see a very, very close correlation. And that's what you need to watch. That's kind of on a shorter term or a longer term as well.
If you're not a currency trade, why does that matter?
I'm just saying that if you want to understand why a particular yield move might have happened, you should look at dollar yen because it's very highly correlated to treasury yields at the moment for year to date. And right now, the CME yen futures from the CFTC COT positioning data, levered funds, so hedge funds essentially, are very, very short dollar yen. So if you get a situation where you get a rush to cover and buying of dollar yen, which is currently, the yen is one of the worst performing macro assets year to date, as I mentioned before, if you get a pull down in USDJPY, you might get a concurrent pull down in the longer end of the curve or the belly of the curve as well.
Interesting. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for watching. To everyone at home, thank you, Samuel, and thank you, Weston. Oh, I should say, tomorrow I'll be interviewing Chris Whalen, who's a banking analyst, and I'll be asking him about the looming bank earnings that are going to be coming in over the next few weeks. How is he viewing bank share buybacks, bank dividend recapitalization, now that they've passed their stress tests with flying colors? And he'll also be taking a somewhat stern look at other fintech companies that he thinks are trying to reinvent the wheel, but he thinks maybe are don't pass the smell test. So that will be a Real Vision Live tomorrow. And then, of course, on our essential tier, we have the interview about credit default swaps and looming credit risk with David Menaret. But thank you so much for watching, and we will be here tomorrow on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Thank you.